Welcome back. I'm Pierre Daly, Managing Editor at AdvisorAnalyst.com, and this is Raise Your Average. Co-hosting with me is Rodrigo Gordillo, President at Resolve Asset Management. Hey, Rod.
How you doing?
All right. How about you?
Good, good. It's been a while. I'm glad to be back.
Yeah, it has been a while. I think I haven't seen you since last year.
Yeah, we've been busy on, on many other fronts, but glad to be back.
That's all good. That's good. You guys have been busy in a good way. So we've got Jeff Weniger, head of equity strategy, and Samuel Rhines, macro strategist, both from the ETF powerhouse known as WisdomTree. Welcome, Samuel. Welcome back, Jeff. It's great to have you on, especially at this moment we're in. It's been quite the year so far.
It's our pleasure. We appreciate you calling it a powerhouse. We crossed over $100 billion a few months ago. And yeah, it's a top 10 provider doing this with skeleton crew of about 250 employees, which to me is a skeleton crew compared to some of the big giants.
Oh, hashtag envy, man. Well done. Amazing work, honestly. You guys have always done great stuff. So I'm glad that that's huge. I mean, what an accomplishment. All due to both of you guys' commentaries, to be honest. I mean, let's call it spade a spade.
Absolutely. Probably less to do with me.
Well, no, you've been there. Maybe not at the forefront, but you've been there you were previously at Corbu before coming on at WisdomTree. And you guys were working with WisdomTree, right?
We were, yes. Yes. And so in the background.
Yeah. So don't sell yourself short.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast are those of the individual guests and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of AdvisorAnalyst.com or of our guests. This broadcast is meant to be for informational purposes only. Nothing discussed in this broadcast is intended to be considered as advice.
So, guys, we're at the beginning of, it's May 8th. Right? It's the beginning of what is traditionally known as a seasonally weak period for equities in general. We had a really big run-up in the beginning of the year, in the first quarter, and in equities specifically. And then, of course, we had a complete backing up of treasuries. But we've given all that back, right? We've given all that back. And while we've given all that all those gains in duration in the bond market, which were being heavily bet on in things such as TLT, equity markets roared forward. So now we're in this spot where, you know, equities maybe are vulnerable and bonds are attractive, and we're entering the seasonally favorable period for bonds and the seasonally weak period for stocks. So what are your thoughts on that?
And I can go ahead and start, Sam. And this is one of those things that was, I don't know, Rod. I mean, you think it's probably the primary driver behind why we got that hiccup between, I think it was March 28th and April 19th in equities, was this notion that for the first time, maybe once again, that we have to digest this reality of these yields in the fours here and pushing five on a 10-year T-note. And sometimes you reach these thresholds in markets where we don't really, quote unquote, care about something until we suddenly do. And you know, I guess one of the concepts that's critical here is that at least in a 60-40 portfolio, that the risk to an asset allocator beforehand was that the 40 was going to, at least theoretically, it was the helpful part of it was supposed to diversify the equity risk, but you had a negative yield perhaps at what was $19 trillion worth. But now at least, after this absolute carnage that has persisted in fixed income since 2022, at least you do get some of that diversifying effect. The other thing that would be positive, we'll have to see if it ends up playing out, is that at least there is some indication that bonds do want to zig while equities zagged a little bit more this year, as opposed to a couple of years ago when, yikes, they were both selling off in tandem. That's a nightmare. That's an absolute nightmare for the entire industry. Guys, I mean, if you think about basically the way every advisor is allocating assets, these are the two asset classes, and then everything else is just, give me a few percentage points into this and a few percentage points into that. It's really just, equities, and it's all U.S. equities, and then fixed income is all U.S. fixed income by and large. Also, at least now there is some of that more diversifying effect here, but you know, kind of a little bit of a rough tape since late March.
Yeah, and it's and it's been pretty interesting how well the market actually held up. I think that's one of the really encouraging parts is the equity market held up, particularly U.S. equities, held up pretty well, even with that backup in yields, right? There was a minor correction, but it was kind of like a, it was kind of a blip. And if you think about that as, you know, are yields really going to move that much higher from here? You know, that's a pretty encouraging sign for those that aren't selling in May and going away. And not to mention the U.S. dollar has been a really interesting kind of hedge with the backup in yields and equities and fixed income kind of moving in tandem over the last couple of years. It's really been the dollar that's been an interesting part of, call it that 60-30-10 type portfolio.
When I'm and looking there, so, I get the, oh, I'm sorry, Rod, I'm pulling 450 here on a 10-year T-note. And then you have to ask yourself, you know, what is inflation really? You know, because we've gone through, I say we, the industry, we've gone through picking apart the CPI. It's artificially elevated because of the follow through of owner's equivalent rent, which I know, Rod, we've gone over this a million times.
Yeah.
And then you also have some of these other issues that are kind of just really sticking points, the auto insurance, the homeowners insurance, and these types of things. But if you have 450 on a T-note, what really is U.S. inflation, at least at a moment in time, on a year-over-year basis, it might be a two-handle. And so you have a real yield here that is called another two-handle, and that's satisfactory for fixed income. The issue, of course, is, you know, you get slapped around by Twitter or something if you say inflation is now maybe contained or has come down, because the example I always use is, well, Cheerios go from $4 to $9, and now Cheerios are $8.90, and you say inflation is no problem. You know,
this is a massive misunderstanding about how people hear about inflation. It's mostly our fault, right? When we discuss inflation being like, inflation has gone down. Inflation has not gone down to the same levels as 2020. The rate of inflation growth has gone down, right? Mm-hmm. That's a completely different thing. If your Cheerios went from 4 to 9, they're going to stick around 9 for a long time. They're not, this inflation is not necessarily true for the basket. It could be true for oil. It could be true for any single item in the basket, but not necessarily true for the whole thing.
Yeah, because we're talking
year over year inflation, not inflation levels going back down to what they were in 2020.
Well, that's the thing, right? There's a lot of misperception by the public that somehow, you know, it's the growth of the growth of prices. It's the second derivative, right? It's not that, you know, that we're hearing about. It's not that prices are coming down anytime soon. They're just not growing. They're just not going up as quickly as they were last year.
But Jeff, can we dig a little deeper into the components of CPI that you just mentioned? Because I think the big discussion here is, when you look at the U.S. economy in particular, you're still seeing strength in, you know, job growth. Jobs seem to be in good shape. And you and the Fed, really what they want to do is they want to reduce demand. I mean, that's what they've been trying to do this whole time, reduce demand at a reasonable rate. And they just have not been able to crack that labor market. And I think that's why they're keeping those rates high. And the world is waiting for them to loosen on the short end. But I kind of think that ultimately what's going to end up happening is you're going to have the long end go up. But what does all that mean in relation to the CPI basket and what those drivers are that you just mentioned?
Well, the labor market is the one that's been most confounding for me, because a lot of the macro indicators through the years, you kind of throw them right out the window. And it's because something happened during COVID, and when none of us can really place our finger on exactly on what it is. I mean, Sam, some of your NFIB pick-aparts lately saying, you know, and we pointed this, because inside the NFIB, National Federation of Independent Businesses survey, there's all these sub-questions. You know, we always kind of take these headline numbers, but you have the sub questions in there. How hard is it to fill your vacancies and that type of thing? And these have been the indicators where the responses sometimes differ from what is happening on the ground. The responses can be downright grisly, I mean, sometimes I'll get inside some of these surveys and I'll see on something like a new orders or something on a CapEx indications or something like that in any one of these 20 surveys that we look at. And it's like, whoa, the number is at 2008 levels. And that is frequently what you start to see in some of these. Sam, what were you seeing with the NFIB stuff?
The NFIB stuff was downright horrible, right? It was really, and it was somewhat detached from reality, which is interesting because you do tend to have that type of movement in some of these surveys, particularly ones that ask pretty, call it easy to answer questions that are pretty broad, right? They're a little hollow when you really read what they're asking these participants. When you look at what they're answering, they're really answering from either it feels this way, right? They feel like it's not going to be good. They feel like it hasn't been great for them. But at the same time, if your revenues haven't been positive for 2 years, you're probably not going to be in business. So to a certain degree, when you read these questions, you're sitting there just wondering what in the world they're actually talking about, because the economy has been growing on a nominal basis, 6 to 7%. I mean, they probably have never experienced nominal growth at that level for their business. And it's always interesting to go under the hood and try to figure out what's actually going on. And there's a lot of politics that plays into a lot of these surveys as well, how they're feeling about a certain political party. And it is an election year. So you get even more of that fuzz in the data.
When you get this lagged effect, because you think about if it was March of 22 that Jay Powell got moving. And also, we oftentimes harken back to that tightening cycle from 04 to 06, because that took policy rates from 1 up to 5.25. And 5.25 to 5.50 is our number. So we're on that number now. But okay, it's been 25, 26 months since this ball got rolling. Meantime, here we are in earnings season. Sam, where are we on a beat rate here on a bottom line number? It's 81, something like that. And it's a pretty solid earnings season. Quarters after the world's largest central bank got tightening. Now there's other effects in here. Go ahead, Sam.
Yeah. Well, and it is really interesting because earnings season does give you an idea of where some of the stuff we've been talking about with inflation is heading, that I think is often overlooked, but very, very useful. So we were talking about the grocery store a second ago, and you look at something like Kraft Heinz in their investor presentation, they break out what their pricing is and kind of give you a little bit of guidance. And there's a slide where they show what their pricing is in the U.S., developed markets and emerging markets. And they came out and said, we're done pushing price in the US and developed markets for the year. They're done. Their pricing's already in the system. Emerging markets, different story. But in the US, they're done putting price into the system. So the growth rate is going to be pretty close to zero. But again, that level is not going down anytime soon. And on the same slide, they had this really interesting thing where they said, hey, it's a lot less competitive on the shelf, right? They're not discounting anywhere near as much as they were in 2019. So after all of these companies had pushed all of this price, not only are they saying, we're not going to cut price, but they're also saying it's not as competitive, right? We're not seeing the discounting that we saw in 2019. So that's a pretty interesting take on the level's not going down. The level is probably not going up that much, but also they're not getting pushback from the consumer in a way that is causing them to go in and put their marketing dollars into promotions, right? That's a really interesting comment on the consumer at the grocery store.
Everybody's fully employed, right? This is the thing. I think like the Fed, I don't think has done enough to make this, to create this weakness from the come from demand, right? So the order of operations has to be the Fed tightens enough where you start seeing the equity market suffer. Once the equity market suffer, it gives the companies the ability to start saying, listen, maybe we don't hire as much, maybe we're not going to give you the extra raise internally, or maybe they start getting their margins hit a little bit more, at which point you really start seeing kind of that repetitive cycle where equities start going down, rates are, we get a normal yielding yield curve, and we allow the Fed to start cutting in the front end. But until we see that weakness, it's just not going to happen. And I just don't see the Fed or the Treasury taking the proper steps to really break that the back of that demand. They're kind of trying to have this soft landing, and they're just we're in no man's land. We just keep on creating this this strong market, a little bit more of inflation based on that, even though there are other sectors that are kind of easing. I think the long end is going to eventually do the job for them, even though it keeps on giving us head fakes these last few weeks.
The things that potentially could have broken the market got sorted out last year, right? Well, you know, following regional bank failures, SVB, Signature Bank, Republic, First Republic, you know, like that ordinarily, that would have, if they hadn't stepped in with that BTFD, you know, that could have gone crazy. I mean, that could have been the breakage that you're talking about, Rod. I think the fact that they put a Band-Aid on it, at least for now, indefinitely, underneath it all, there was the news from, you know, about Bank of America recently and what the book value of their assets was. And, you know, instead of being, I think, somewhere north of 200 something billion, 250 billion, it was closer to 100 billion. Was their I think their held to maturity assets. And so, you know, the BTFD is just smoothing things over until maturity for all these assets that are held by banks. But if they hadn't done that, where would we be right now if they hadn't done that?
And I was surprised,
you know, in terms of the big picture.
And also not mentioning is Credit Suisse.
Credit Suisse, NYCB. You know, more recently, New York Community Bank, right? So,
And one of the things that I've been surprised about, surprised is an understatement, this concept that we were using about a year ago, which needs to maybe go into the dustbin of history, the bank walk, which was not the bank run, the bank walk, which was basically Rodrigo telling his next door neighbor, "Hey, what are you doing? Still sitting there overnight savings account over at your local savings and loan. You're earning 0.01 or you're earning 0.5. You can go over to money markets and get a five handle. Why haven't you done it?" And when you look at it, it basically just picture in your mind the J. Powell tightening cycle. We've been at five for plenty of time for people to engage the bank walk. But I encounter it all the time. People say, "Hey, Jeff, I got this money. What should I buy right now?" "Okay, tell me what you have." "Well, I've got this checking account over here at Wells, and I've got this other checking account over here at B of A." And then you start summing it up and you're saying, "Ay, ay, ay."
Understand. Like I'm in the business. This is what I do for a living. And I also educate people on these topics. My own father, which I speak with a couple times a week, for the last year and a half, I've been like, "Dad, you got 150,000 sitting in Royal Bank. Can we please like paying you nothing? Basically not. Can we just move it to a Fidelity account? We'll buy you money market, or even just buy a goddamn GIC." He's like, "Well, I gotta get to that, son. I'll do it next week." There seems to be, and he's not the only one, right?
Well, but you know what they say, like, because I need my 6 months.
I don't know how to do it because it hasn't happened for so long.
They give you that 6 months.
People don't know how to buy GICs. And
they give you 6 months of liquidity line, and you're like, "Where?"
6 months of liquidity.
If I want to get rid of
my selling.
Yeah, if I want to get rid of my ETF that I use, that 150K, and you buy some very, very short dated, treasury ETF or something like that. Well, you just liquidate the amount you need to pay your bills here and there. Wait for T+2, which is going to T+1 in late May, I think, over at Schwab, let's say. And then later on in the week, there's your money. You don't need 6 months of liquidity in the checking account. You just need 6 months of liquidity in T-bills in any account.
it has been so surprising. I don't know if the banks are creating some sort of tide selling, you know, well, if you haven't this cast, then you won't get these services. I'm not sure, but there is certainly a friction there from either just putting their money into some sort of locked in 90-day, you know, short-term bond within the bank, or moving it to a brokerage account to buy a money market fund. But it is slow moving. And maybe we're just not used to it. Nobody can believe that you make all the effort and then a lot of people, I think, are fearing that they'll be back down to 1.5 yields. So what's the point? You know what I mean?
Well, we sit here, we take it for granted, right? I mean, we talk about things where you could do this, you could do that, you could put it here, you could put it there. Mm-hmm. But that's, you know, that's very practical conversation. But, you know, getting to it and doing it from an emotional standpoint is also another factor. But I think you're right, Rod. There's a lot of friction to do that. You know,
inertia is a real thing. And I think in small businesses too, they say, you know, you have to keep this certain amount in balance here in your checking account so that we can give you these other loan services when you need them, you know, these lines of credit and whatnot. So I think it's a lot more complicated than that, than what I would have expected to happen after SVB, which is, you know, shocking, but it is what it is. So the banks continue to be, I guess they're also not as levered as they were back in 2008. So we've seen a lot of buffering of,
And there was also
in a very particular scenario.
In the Fed senior loan officer survey, there were indications of notable tightening 3 or 4 quarters ago, and that has come off the boil a little bit in recent quarters. So lending activity may be just fine and dandy. It's intriguing. I mean, look, you don't want to make too much hay out of a 49 print on PMIs, because that's just one respondent flipping the coin, and the next thing you know, you're north of 50. But on manufacturing and services in this country, in the United States, we are a 49 handle on both of those. And so that's something to keep in mind, because if you're long financials, I mean, do you necessarily want to be long financials in a recession? That could be problematic. But, when you go back to the last time that you really had to worry about financials, global financial crisis, that one market, the housing market, it is a different situation now. It's a bubble, but it's also one of those situations where there truly is not that inventory. There was a ton of building going on in 03, 04, 05. And that has not necessarily been the case in this cycle. Some area, multifamily, there's been a ton of building. But we have a much bigger population base than back then. So if there needs to be something to come along and be a global financial crisis type thing, what I keep coming back to is, well, the best guess has to be commercial real estate. But if it's commercial real estate, and it is now May of 2024, then you've had 50 months to liquidate that position. 50 months dating back to March 2020, the first time you said, gee, I wonder if people are going to come into an office anymore. Right. So if you haven't liquidated that position just yet and panicked out of it, when do you intend to do that? And so the thing about a crisis is, crisis is supposed to be something that comes up and surprises you. Is anybody surprised about the intense?
It seems to be managed, right? People are managing the situation. It's a lot slower. And listen, I guess in our lifetimes, in our professional careers, at least the recent professional careers, everything has seemed to happen all at once. Mm-hmm. But as I read through kind of veteran and talk through veteran global macro guys that have been around in the 70s, what they tell me is that macro moves very slowly, very slowly. We're talking about 18 months to 2 years to see a shift in any one of the major factors. So I think we just got to, in this particular cycle, it's been more macro than ever, right? It's been very, very slow moving. And for every piece that the Fed moves in the chessboard, it's going to take a while to get the effect. And, you know, real estate is one of those things that we're all learning takes a lot longer than we think to get and take a direction and have an effect. Especially given the dynamics in the U.S., right? I wonder how it might be different in Canada, but in the U.S. especially, Jeff, I know you've talked and written a lot about it. We're like, can you give us some more insights into real estate in the U.S. these days and what you're seeing in that space?
Well, I mean, it's an interesting one because it's not so much about prices, going up or going down. It's almost like a labor market rigidity issue. And I think there's a, I think people get it, but haven't given it as much thought as some of us have about what it truly means to have people stuck in their homes. And now, Rod, going back to your old Toronto days, if you're stuck in your home in Toronto, which is what, the third largest population zone in North America? And I'm in Chicago, yep. and Sam is in Houston. Pierre, where are you, Pierre?
I'm in Toronto.
In Toronto.
Yeah.
So if Wisdom Tree fires me today, I'm in Chicago. And not only do I have to worry about my employment, but I have to worry about my wife's employment as well. Well, she's also in Chicago, as opposed to, let's say, 75 minutes from here in a cornfield. If I lose my job, that's a major concern because, well, the job in that cornfield needs to be in Chicago, right? Or I suppose Milwaukee. Now, but I'm out in the cornfield. I have a 3% mortgage. And maybe somebody was employing me 5 minutes from my house there. But now that there's one job offer, and that job offer is in Chicago's Loop, the financial district, and I must take it because I have to pay my bills. And now I have a 75 minute commute into downtown Chicago. If you lose your job in Toronto, you find another job in Toronto. If you lose your job in Houston, you find another job in Houston. Now, the asterisk on all this is remote work. Maybe you lose your job in Toronto and you find one in LA and they say, just fly out quarterly and visit us. Right. But the issue is if I'm locked in at 3 and I'm stuck in Chicago, I could probably find employment, but that employment almost has to be specifically Chicago, but I'm okay because it's a big metro zone. Whereas before, assuming Jessica and I didn't have the kids, we could probably up and go out to New York or something for the next job because it's like, look, come on, let's go. We have a better job out in New York, let's say.
Right.
And now you're at, where are we, 7 and 8 on at least on a conforming yep. mortgage, and jumbos are always plus or minus an eighth in this new age of jumbos being approximately equal to conforming mortgages. You're looking at 400 and some odd basis points of a gap up to leave. And, you know, we had a 3% mortgage at the old place. It's like, I'm looking at these statements. It's all principal, no interest because we were deep on the mortgage. But man, when you look at some of the math on this, you are looking at, we've done this and I have to back the envelope. Don't quote me on this, but you know, the person who, let's take like a $500,000 house and they locked in 3, if they want to have the same monthly nut, they can only get a $300,000 house. So how do you even take this job transfer? That's the issue. It's like home prices right. going up, home prices going down. It's lack of transactions, lack of being able to leave Chicago to go to LA. And so there's a labor market dynamism component. And then also this thing that we talked about as well, maybe it's trumped by our new social predilection for doing home remodeling. It was like everybody remodels their homes and stuff. That was not a thing when I was a kid. People didn't remember. People didn't really remodel their house. Now it seems like people do that. Yeah, but the thing I've pointed out for some time is those drafty windows. They can wait. The only time you fix those drafty windows is when basically your realtor says, "Hey, you're gonna have to fix those drafty windows before I list this thing," or the home inspector says the windows are drafty, fix it. Or give us a credit to the buyers. And if we're not transacting because we're all stuck at these 3% mortgages, it's just like putting a stick in the spokes of a bicycle. It grinds activity to a halt. I mean, thus far the economy's looked the other way on it, but it's more and more people are going to get roped into this because you could say, oh, let's wait another year to have this baby. Okay, let's wait another year to have this baby. Oh, now we've got the baby's born. And a lot of people, you know, as the years go on, they're going to have no choice but to act, and they're going to end up paying double their previous payment, or in some cases, triple.
Well, yeah, and it's really interesting because coming out of the financial crisis, we had the you're underwater on your house issue, mm-hmm. right? That was kind of the, not necessarily the same thing, but it certainly lowered your ability to move to that next opportunity and mm-hmm. likely slowed that recovery over time. And what's intriguing about this notion of people being trapped in their homes, maybe not able to take that job, you know, a little bit of a damper on labor market dynamism, is if you look at some of the indicators during COVID when it was very easy, or right after COVID when it was very easy, very cheap to find that home, quits skyrocketed. And it wasn't just quits, you know, for jobs that, you know, were leisure and hospitality and just flipping to get a few more dollars. It was a lot of jobs at a lot of the higher paying type of industries, finance, even manufacturing, where sometimes you have to move to find a higher paying manufacturing job. A lot of those industries were seeing incredible numbers of quits. And you've begun to see that tick lower, right? You've begun to really see quits and even layoffs just grinding lower as people are they're just happy to stay where they are, right? You know, partially because they're trapped in their home, but also partially because there's been so much switching over the last 4 or 5 years that there might be a little burnout, both on the side of corporations who are probably sick of trying to fill the same job, but also on the, you know, the side of the employee who's like, no, I'm settled. I had the house, you know, I have my 3-4% mortgage. I'm not going to move. I'm going to stay right here. So I do think that this is going to have a lasting effect on the labor market that hasn't filtered into the data fully yet.
And they're getting the bonuses they asked for too. Let's not forget that, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Like they are getting the raises. They are able to maintain their lifestyle. So when companies are flush with cash and somebody demands a higher wage, they're getting it these days. So all of that kind of adds up to a slower shift from the housing
side. And there's the echo. I mean, there's the echo, you know, I'm listening to our conversation here, and there's the echo from the Fed too, which has been consistently since they did this rapid cycle of rate hikes, you know, now we're going to wait and see. Let's just wait and see. Let's wait and see. Let's wait for something to happen. Let's wait for some indication that things are changing. And that's what people are doing too, right? Everybody's doing the same thing. I can't, you know, I don't want to move because of this. I don't want to have to get a new mortgage. I don't want to have to, you know, I'm going to wait and see what happens. Maybe something will change and then we'll be able to do something else. And you know, it feels like we're just in this holding pattern in, you know, at the micro level, but also at the macro level.
And so, how long are you in that? Go ahead, Rob.
Go ahead, Jeff.
I was going to say, okay, so let's say it's 7 and 1/8. Somebody pull up on another screen. I think it's 7 and 1/8 when I looked. And we said 450 on a T-note. And what people oftentimes say is, well, why shouldn't you compare it to long bonds? It's a 30-year mortgage 7. Compared 2, to a 30. The reason is because for everybody you know who stayed in their house 30 years, serviced a mortgage for 30 years, you know a lot more people who moved or sold the place or paid the thing off early. So we typically will compare a 30-year mortgage to a 10-year T-note. And if you're at 450 and 7 1/8, then you're, 2 5/8 north of it. Now, historically, that gap was more like 150, 175 basis points. And this goes back to one of these other issues on the 60-40, which is on the equity side, VIX for bull is with 13. Where's the VIX, guys? It was 13 yesterday on the VIX. Okay, but the VIX for fixed income, which is the MOVE index, it's wild. We have intense volatility on the fixed income side. Stock market's doing just fine. As Sam pointed out, that retracement that we had, not even a retracement, from March 28th to April 19th was 200 or 300 points on an S&P that was at 5,200. Went from 5,200 to 4,900. It was a forgettable sell-off. And even in that instance, the VIX... Well, what did the VIX do? Went up to 18 or 19? Maybe. But you have this intense fall on the fixed income side.
And now we're back to 13 on the VIX.
Yeah, so 13 on the VIX, but the MOVE index is up here in the sky.
Yeah.
And so instead of talking on 150 for a mortgage rate over and above a 10-year T-note, which let's say it was 150, then you're at a 6% mortgage, not 7 1/8. But as long as this fixed income fall sits there, you have this head scratcher going on. It's like, look, I know 6% also stinks when you're at 3, but it is 115, 120 basis points better than 7 and 8. So that's the other issue, is how long is this going to persist, this bond market volatility? Because you could get in a rosy scenario where, you know, maybe you get the budget deficit back in order, maybe the bond market starts calming down, something like that. Maybe if you get a fixed income rally and a narrowing of that spread, that could be some sort of salvation for this rigidity in housing. But for now, it's persisting and it's frustrating.
Yeah. Well, again, everything's getting longer and longer to see change, right? So I'm kind of getting used to that. Kind of getting used to, like, looking out, you know, 18 months rather than the next 3 months to see what's going to happen. Sam, I know that you looked at kind of the changing dynamics in the economy, in the U.S. economy in particular, from kind of manufacturing and goods versus services. Can you tell us a little bit about that and what that means and what you're seeing there?
Sure. You know, it's a pretty well-trod story that coming out of the pandemic, it was, you know, we were transitioning from a goods-driven economy during the pandemic when we were all trapped at home, buying a new couch, TV, whatever it might have been, to a, you know, more of a goods and services, right? That handoff was actually a little bit better and easier than I think many people anticipated, right? We didn't hit as many speed bumps there. It just kind of went back to everybody wanted to go to a restaurant. Everybody wanted to go on a cruise. Everybody wanted to get on a plane and go to Disney. It was a pretty sharp change in the economy, right? People stopped buying goods and they all went on vacation, right? It was a summer of fun. What's intriguing is now you're beginning to see somewhat of a normalization of those services back towards kind of a normal economy. I think that's really important to keep in the back of our heads when we talk about the potential slowing of services. Is it really a slowing of services, or is it simply a normalization back to something a little bit closer to normal, right? You know, yes, hotels maybe, you know, aren't seeing what they saw 6-9 months ago. They probably shouldn't see what they were seeing 6-9 months ago when we were coming out of that, or a year ago. So that's not really, in my mind, disconcerting. What would be disconcerting is if we saw some sort of significant structural change in the underlying dynamics of the economy, right? And so you're still seeing people go on vacations. Disney, you know, had fine earnings when it came to, you know, people going to the parks. You see United, American, airlines all saying, you know, demand's holding up. We're getting bookings. People are going to Europe. People are going to LATAM, et cetera. You hear every cruise line on the planet saying we have bookings at higher prices and we've never seen this many pre-books.
That's the craziest part to me after COVID.
Yep. Yeah. Exactly.
You're dead. I mean,
what are you?
Could you think about a worse business to have been hit by COVID? I mean, all the bad press that they got. It's come back alive. It's crazy.
It's incredible. And, you know, it speaks to what the consumer is willing to do. One of the encouraging things that I think gets overlooked a lot is just how bad manufacturing has been. Like, it has been bad for the better part of 18 months in the United States. It just does not seem to want to tick back up. Mm. And while, you know, a lot of people would look at that and say, this is bad, this is, you know, something that points towards a recession or a slowing economy. To me, when you have that long of a, call it a rolling recession in manufacturing, that's not a bad thing if you're looking out 6 to 12 months for the U.S. economy. Right. That means you really have normalized inventories across a number of industries. You'll have freight begin to come back. You'll begin to hear about, you know, some underlying fundamentals in the U.S. economy improving. And I think it might be a little bit surprising to people that it comes from the manufacturing side. And then it completely changes the conversation that we're having in 6 to 12 months. Right. I think that's a really intriguing part, is the U.S. economy is so dynamic that you can have an entire segment of it in absolute distress. I mean, you read the Dallas Fed Manufacturing Index comments, It's one of the most entertaining things you can do on a monthly basis is listen to what those people are saying about politics, the economy, inflation, et cetera. You know, it's really intriguing that the U.S. economy is such a dynamic place that we can have services keep the economy not just afloat, but semi-booming while manufacturing has been dragging. It's just that to me is an encouraging sign for the economy as we move forward.
Yeah, I agree. And so let's talk about all of this. You know, we talked earlier, Jeff, about the 60-40 and how people basically the whole industry is a 60-40 portfolio. As these dynamics play out, we saw some play out in 2022. We continue to see a strong economy in the U.S. I mean, let's be honest. The U.S. has recovered. The 60-40 has recovered, but only because of that 60, right? Bonds are still down. They were they went down and stayed down and continue to stay down in terms of price recovery, not yield. And so how should people be thinking about asset allocation here? Like, what are they missing or what should they be thinking about allocating to?
Well, and we haven't talked about foreign equities, and we have initiatives, you know, kind of, there's some industrial policy going on the world over. That's one of these concepts that, that's,
I'm betting, Jeff, you're just dying to talk about Japan.
Well, I mean, it could apply to Europe, it could apply to Korea, China, some of these initiatives. One of the things we don't really have going on in the United States, only a little bit around the edges. I'll give you an example. You know, we have this concept of the long-term part-time. And now with the Secure Act 2.0, used to be, oh, you went in on this 401k? Sorry. You're a part-time employee. That might have been the refrain at many corporations. And now, with the Secure Act 2.0, a lot of the long-term part-time are going to get put into their, they're going to get auto-enrolled too. So you got the libertarian paternalism in that form. And then once that person is in the 401k, surprise, they buy U.S. equities. And one of the things that we've been noticing overseas where it's not really a, there's no, the difference is it's not hard to get Americans to buy U.S. stocks. This is the group of people that like to buy their own domestic stock market. It's getting Japanese or getting Koreans to invest in their own country's stock markets, which have been moribund for so many years until recently, right? With both of those, either Kospi might be making a new high as we speak. We'll have to see. But you have some of these initiatives. And we've talked about this, Rod, in many conversations with this concept that I have, which is the pension wars, which is basically what can we do in the DB and the DC side of the business to encourage either institutions or individuals to buy our own stocks? So the Brits put forth the British ISA, which is basically a 5,000 British pound tack on to your retirement account contribution max with each passing year, because they're having their moment of truth over there in London. And then the Japanese, which I think is extremely notable because we're thinking asset allocation, Rod, the MSCI All Country World is 62-63% U.S. equities. And I talk about Japan so much because the number two country there is Japan, and it's five.
Yeah.
So you're
is that right?
What?
Oh, 5%? I didn't know that.
Yep. Yeah, so it's 62% of the global equity basket is this country, called this country, and then five for this country, which is Japan, and then it's like three or four for China, and everybody else is down the list. Canada, I know there's a lot of Canadians on the line here. Canada's like 2.5 or 3, right? And that's basically the mix. And so you can't fault a lot of asset allocators for giving no attention to what's happening in German industry, let's say. But with this five that's in Japan, they just tripled up on January 1st, the maximum contribution that you can make into your own individual retirement account. In USD terms, it was about $8,000. Now it's $24,000. So if they did that here in this country, where you could put 7,000 into a traditional IRA and your spouse can put 7,000. And then suddenly there was an announcement Hey, by the way, it's not going to be 7,000 anymore. It's going to be 21,000 or something. You know, the whole street would be talking about it as their bull case for the S&P. Now, look, the incremental $14,000 from you, is not moving the needle, but it's more about the psychology of creating the equity ownership society. And that's the thing that they're doing in Japan with
right.
the asset. It's called the asset income doubling plan, which is essentially get out of JGBs, which are still right. at zero, and buy equities. And we'll see if that is a catalyst for the bull case continuing in that country. But I'm seeing similar initiatives out of the Brits, definitely out of the Koreans. And one of the things that I've been noticing, that letter that the Canadian CEOs wrote.
I was going to say.
45, what was that, 45 or 60 days ago. Sam, did you see that?
I did, yes.
There were some zingers in there. For the viewer who hasn't seen it, I mean, I don't know how much this made the rounds in Canadian equity circles. But basically they said, you own 4% of your pension system in Canada, you, the pension industry. And then the zinger in that, it was a letter that they wrote to the Globe and Mail and everybody, all the newspapers. The zinger was, this is less than you own in Chinese equities. And why you only have 4% of your assets allocated. So that's
I think the reply was the market cap of Canadian equities is 2.5. So their response was, we have doubled what we should do based on market cap weighting. Mm-hmm. Then so you know, we're already doing our part. And this is where the pushback's gonna be, right? How much do we want to have what would be considered a totalitarian push mm-hmm. to say you need to own more of our domestic equities and distort the prices there, as you know, pension plans, you need to start doing this, when they're already, in their view, doing their part. And also they have so much money, Ontario Teachers, mm-hmm. Canadian pension plan, that they can't allocate. There's not enough liquidity in the Canadian market to allocate all the dollars. But I do agree that there is a nationalistic push that will be interesting to see play out in terms of relative performance in the stock markets between U.S. Equities and global.
And remember this, it's not whether you agree with the ethics of that push or right. whether this is what you would do if you were in a position of power. It's, this is the policy proposal. It may not be official. There's no sheet of paper that says you must do this. It's just the political push. And how do you allocate assets based on the things that are occurring on the ground? And so what you sit here and you say is, okay, well, wait a minute. If I'm sitting over here in London and I see that, oh, look, the Canadians are actually doing it. Look, teachers just upped their Canadian equity allocation, let's say, hasn't happened. That gives you more political power back in Britain to say, by the way, take a wild guess. This is what the joke I make. The Canadian pension system's allocation to Canadian equities is 4. The British pension system's allocation to British equities, take a wild guess, guys, 4.
And following the queen, man.
And yeah. And the other thing, Sam, is, you know, the Brits had with the liability-driven investing.
Yes.
That blew up on them in 2022. So you also have a palpable story. Hey, I'm just trying to protect our pensioners here. What if the gilts market blows up again like it did in 22? I must buy FTSE. So you can smell this in several nations, Britain, Canada, Korea. I'm waiting to see if they do it in Japan. I'm always seeing it on the defined contribution side in Japan right now, but I'm thinking the Japanese pension system is also going to do it because there needs to be a two-way street, which is, all right, we've asked you, the individual, to buy Japanese equities. We've initiated the name and shame list, the corporate governance list. And so to show that we're serious about this, we, the institutions of Japan, or the institutions of Britain and so forth, we're going to put more into domestic equities as well. And you got to sell something to do that. And there's that 62, 63% U.S.
Yeah.
So I think developed markets
and bonds.
Developed markets have quite a chance.
Now, the other thing, is what I've seen historically in terms of relative performance between international equities and U.S. equities has a lot to do with the dollar and the commodity supercycle, right? So there is something to be said about if inflation is here and we're going to have spikes. We've always at Resolve talked about that it's not going to be inflation all the time, but rather inflation volatility. Mm-hmm. Where we're going to go, you know, from massive bursts of inflation to disinflation, hit aggressively by the Fed and the powers that be, and they're not going to do enough. So inflation is going to go back up. So in this inflation volatility environment, you know, there is opportunity here for emerging markets, especially to benefit from the commodity supercycle and start outperforming, right? So that's another area that I think from an asset allocation perspective, don't count out international equities, especially emerging markets.
And it's and it's worth noting that, you know, these are relatively small weightings outside of the United States. So if you have a 2% change in your overall allocation towards some of these markets, it is non-trivial in terms of the flows that you're going to see over time. That is a notable shift. It's also a notable shift that you have to sell dollars typically to do that allocation. So that's
yeah. And look, what's the weighting? What's a commodity weighting in the S&P 500 today? Right, like
if you include materials, 7.5, give or take.
7.5. What was the weighting back in 2007? Right, it was above 20. Right, so this is a very interesting. I mean, this doesn't stay like this forever. Right, there is ebb and flow in that space, and we are very, very underweight in that sector. So
energy too, right? I mean,
energy, you know, utilities, and if that pendulum shifts. I remember. Do you guys remember back in 2007,
the brick super cycle?
Everybody wanted to launch a brick ETF or mutual fund, right? Brazil, yeah. Russia, India, China.
China was the way. If you didn't, then your clients for commodities.
Would destroy you.
You not own China? How can you not own Brazil? And today it's the opposite. Today is like, how do you not own S&P 500 at least, if not the Mag 7? Right.
And
so
it goes to there are interesting concepts, and this goes to what we're talking about kind of at the beginning of the call, which is sometimes you've got these theories in your mind with your macro charts. We look at charts all day. And you know, if this happens, then that happens. And, you know, right now, I mean, I'd have to look at the tape and make sure I don't put my foot in my mouth. But if imagine copper and zinc are still as hot as they were when I looked at them last week. And you know, you get copper and zinc at new highs. So the base metals complex in general is doing just fine, which might be very bullish China. Gold keeps wanting to make new high. Where's gold right now, guys? Here, let me pull a quote here. Gold.
Let's take a look.
Gold 23.17 on gold as of now when we're recording.
It has not budged.
Guys, the dollar is super strong. This isn't supposed to happen. I was raised on if the dollar's strong, I'm not supposed to want those things. And so a lot of, you know, there's some humility in macro, which, you know, it's like if you told any of us years ago, oh, you know, by the way, the euro's going to be down at 108, the yen will be at 154, China will be in a question mark type economy. Maybe this is what it's telling us, is that China's going to emerge out of this. And create a bull case. And that, by the way, copper would be making new highs in zinc. Zinc would be doing fine, and so would nickel. And by the way, all-time record highs in gold. That's...
China's the one buying the gold, right? I mean,
that's...
China, among others, China's buying...
That ETF flows have gone down over the last 12 months.
But China's buying all the physical gold they can.
Going up, right? So at some point, generally, retail ends up looking at price and starts buying. So at some point, this is going to become a vicious cycle where they're seeing flows come out, they're looking at the price going up, and retail is going to have to catch up. I don't know. I feel like there is a probability, a high probability here that gold continues to be strong if central banks continue to buy. But I think the ultimate thing for me with regard to gold or commodities or, you know, strategies like managed futures is that I would say, you know, 10 years ago, 5 years ago, it was really tough to make a case for a high probability of inflation, a high probability of bear market. Today, what's that probability? Is it zero that we're going to have another inflation thrust? Is it zero that we're going to have that inflation cause the long end to go up and equities to go down and have a bear market? I think the probabilities are much higher on the macro side for every one of those pieces, right? So to put all of your money on equities and bonds and think that you're going to be okay in this environment, I think is a bad idea. Maybe it's not 100% gold. Nothing should be like, no, but none of us have a perfect foresight on any of this stuff, but you should start thinking about increasing exposures to these things, increasing exposure to gold commodities to manage futures trend, which is a favorite of ours, right? That'll help you navigate this market a bit more. And I think that's what's missing here. People look at their portfolios and like, well, I'm back to normal. I'm like, no, just disaggregate your bond side and see how bad you're still hurting mm-hmm. from bonds. That's another thing I don't get, guys. Mm-hmm. I was like, If somebody would have told me, hey, by the way, that TLT is going to be down 55% and stay down for 12 months, mm-hmm. I would have thought the world was going to come to a stop. Everybody would be losing their minds, but nobody has flinched, right? Mm-hmm. If it's not the equity markets going down, it doesn't matter. That was a baffling.
Yeah, that's bizarre, yeah. Actually. You're right about that. Like TLT, the buying in TLT for all of last year and continuing is confounding.
Well, it's just and you're right. The reaction from
there's no flinch. That's right. There's no negative. There's no backlash from it. It just, you know, it's just continuing. Just crazy. this bet on duration is just continuing. And I mean, it's all sorts of players. It's not just long onlys.
I mean, it's tough to time, mm-hmm. right? It's tough to time, but it is one that should make more sense. It's certainly more valuable now than it was pre-pandemic, right?
Well, that goes back to the other kind of, you know, it was saying, you know, how can gold do this with a strong dollar? You know, the fits on the macro charts were always interest rates, interest rate directionality as opposed to level. And then that was the influence on gold. But here we have interest rate directionality one way from, you know, a few years ago up. And then here we are at gold all-time highs because it was always, well, my bull case is you can keep interest rates down here at zero forever. And therefore, to keep, you know, this safe deposit box of Krugerrands, that's fine. I'm not going to get anything in fixed income. Well, now that you get 4.5 in fixed income, the theory should be that gold should not like that, but gold loves it. And then the other thing that's also, I almost say in the background, I think it's in the foreground. And this is what makes it so difficult is nobody can quantify, you know, like your marginal propensity I'm going to use marginal propensity in the podcast, your yes. marginal propensity to buy asset class A as opposed to asset class B that was invented inside one generation ago. And that asset class is Bitcoin. And so, you know, for me, it's like, okay. If someone was worried about this or that, terrorism, inflation, social breakdown, then that person bought gold. That was what you did. And then now in the last 10 or 15 years, that person, especially if they're more youthful, bought that other asset class and he couldn't get gold to rally. Now have we reached some sort of equilibrium where there is a cohort of those people who bought Bitcoin, people who bought various coins that say, you know, in addition to what I purchased, I'm now willing to also buy gold. It's not A for B, it's now A and B. That is difficult to quantify because we all know people who bought, they say, Jeff, man, I don't like what I'm seeing. You know, the whole system's busted. Look at all this inflation. And then that person went and bought Bitcoin. That was a person that was money that didn't buy Krugerrands. And so I don't know how to quantify it, but that should be issue number one in trying to figure out demand for the yellow metal.
Yeah. And look, it used to be correlated to, well, it is, I think it continues to be. I think it's an interesting anomaly that we're seeing right now, but to real rates, right? When real rates rise, gold ended up generally going down. When real rates go down, gold ends up going up. It's been correlated to, and on the opposite side over the last 3 months, right? So something's happening, something interesting. Yeah. And this is, again, global macro, yeah. You gotta think outside your traditional 60-40 box is my takeaway.
Yeah. Yeah. So one of the things I want to jump in on is, I think Rod had a great point on, you know, this, you know, the metals and super cycle and being kind of, you know, needing to rethink how we're allocating there, because it's incredibly intriguing to me how overlooked it is, the fracture between the West and the major metal producers. If you think back a couple of weekends ago, it was, you know, there were a lot of headlines on the geopolitical front with Iran and Israel, but the real news that was moving markets was Russia was no longer able to put their metals in the CME or LME. That was a tremendously big deal for understanding the future dynamics of supply and demand in the West for metal. That should not be discounted in terms of, you don't necessarily have to have as much demand for oil or for some of these other, you know, base metal commodities if you're going to truly have a fracture of the East and West. That is something that should not be ignored. That adds a significant catalyst to building positions, particularly call it in Europe, you know, friendly countries that have these metals and have exposure to them.
To me, it's these types of frictions that continue to add to the case that we're going to see a lot more inflation volatility, right? When you create these random bottlenecks, these random frictions, when you're onshoring more than you ever did, like all of these things, they don't pop in a single quarter as incredibly obvious to anybody. But over time, it just creates this low-level inflammation that makes us more susceptible to pops and changes in inflation. So again, just another story that makes sense to me.
Well, and some of the best performers last year, everybody talks about the Mag 7. Like, you look underneath the surface and some really boring companies that provide aggregates were some of the best performing companies out there. I mean, there's a company in the UK called CRH that owns a lot of aggregate companies in the United States that performed incredibly well. Outperform part of the Mag 7, Vulcan Materials, MLM. Like, some of these companies are incredibly interesting from the perspective of, if you're going to build a whole bunch of factories with IRA and chip money and install solar panels, guess what? A lot of concrete's needed to do that, right? A lot of rebar, a lot of this boring stuff that people don't really think about underneath the surface was absolutely killing it. And I really think that it really needs to be rethought, the mentality of it's all about these large caps, large caps, large caps. No, it's really not just those that outperform. You have to be paying attention to how policy and how the macro is really shaping the long-term trends here.
Yeah.
You know, on that fracturing of East versus West, one of the things, now, the anti-correlation between Chinese equities and U.S. equities, it's not exactly heartening to an asset allocator that they got negative correlation out of this thing because it was tanking. You know, that's not exactly what you caused. With Chinese equities hit from peak to trough, what do you guys think? Down 2/3 was the worst of it? But, you know, that's one of the things that you, going back to it, is where it's like, okay, largest stock market, and then the third largest stock market. And it truly is the only one showing anti-correlation. And I don't know whether it's because Sam's on the right thesis with East and West fracturing, but that sounds logical. Sounds like a pretty decent thesis to me. And so you start thinking, well, there's a real value to this other asset class, which is Chinese equities, if I know that maybe it might choose to rally when the other things I own are not, and doing the opposite. And you can look at the tape in the last 8 or 10 weeks, and I'd have to pinpoint it, but I think it's first or second week of February is when we bottomed out on Chinese equities. And don't put a number on it, but they're up a lot. 20-some odd percent. I don't think anybody knows, 20-some odd percent since early February. It is perhaps the portfolio diversifier. There's possibly a value case in that country. And if you're going to try to find a silver lining between in global conflict, please don't throw egg on my face for this, finding a silver lining in global conflict and cold wars, it is that it makes asset allocation, at least gives you more choices, because we're not just all ebbing and flowing together, which which in prior cycles was oftentimes the case. So at least you can get something different over there in Chinese equities. That, you know, the thing about a group that went down two thirds is it could go down two thirds again. So
you just have to size it appropriately and diversify globally. As a quant, you want to ask yourself, does it have a positive risk premium above cash?
Mm-hmm.
Probably you're taking risks. It's a growing economy. It does a lot of good stuff, and it'll eventually make money above cash. So allocating to it at the right risk weight makes 100% sense. The problem is right now it's, like you said, 65% U.S. equities.
Well, now MSCI China. So if you're looking at like mainland shares, you are at 700 on an earnings yield, just 700 over the sovereign bond. Sovereign's yielding 2.5, something like that, 2.5. And you're pushing 10% on an earnings yield. Now the pushback is, great, it's all for the CCP, and how are you going to actually collect as a shareholder? And so the bull case for that country is, if these reforms that they're trying to push in come into effect where they can actually get them to pay a dividend. The thing about dividend is it is in my hand. Chinese stocks, it's, I don't know if I want to play that. I'm worried about that. All the usual reasons for legitimate concern. If you can boost these payout ratios out of the basement, much as was the case in Japan, then you can manifest some sort of bull case for the group. 700 over the sovereign. Whereas if you look at U.S. equities, okay, what do we want to say, 21 or 22 times forward earnings on the S&P? What's the number, guys? 21 or 22?
20, yeah.
Let's call it 21. 20.
Mm-hmm.
Let's call it 20. That way makes it easy. So that if it's 20, then you have an earnings yield of 5, 1/20. And we said we're at 450 on the T-note. So you're 50 basis points over the sovereign. And this other market that nobody wants to touch is 700 over the sovereign. For granted, a ton more risk. But at what point can you drive a truck through that margin of safety? I don't know, guys. Looks kind of good to me. We'll see.
Yeah. So, guys, Rod has to go shortly. I wanted to cap off our conversation by asking each of you, respectively, what you're most optimistic about right now, and conversely, what you're most pessimistic about right now.
Hmm. Let's start with Sam so I can think about it.
Sam,
How about Rod goes first?
Okay. Well, look, what I'm most optimistic about right now is, I think, education in the financial space. So I'm not even going to go into markets. I think what we're talking about today, getting people to understand how the global macroeconomy is working, and that reminding them there are now tools available that didn't exist 20 years ago for investors, ability to get into gold, to get into commodities, to get into China, to get into, managed futures trend and, carry strategies and all this stuff. That tends to smooth out people's portfolios much better than 60/40. I'm really excited about that right now. And what I'm not excited about right now is the issue is no longer that the tools aren't there. The issue right now is that the institutions are blocking access to those things because they don't understand it, the big banks and so on. So it's a little disheartening to see people in position of power to say, no, we're not ready for that yet. Right. So retail on their own, yes. Retail with a big institution behind them, kind of a problem. That's what I got.
All right.
And I'm most optimistic about the ability of the U.S. economy to continue to be dynamic moving forward. I think that's going to be the big surprise of 24 and 25, is that the U.S. economy not only came out of COVID very strong, but the underestimation of both the Inflation Reduction Act and CHIPS Act as a significant tailwind to the U.S. economy over a prolonged period of time. I do think that is going to be a significant surprise to the upside, whether it's on the manufacturing front, consumption front, et cetera. I think that's very, very underrated. What I am least optimistic about is U.S.-China relations moving forward. I think that is going to continue to be a headwind. It is one of the few things we can agree upon as, you know, in terms of political parties and political leanings, it seems to be the one bipartisan thing out there. I do think that that is going to continue, and I think the rhetoric is going to get louder and louder as we approach November and emerge from November.
I'm most optimistic on, I think we have several nations reforming. You know, China's looking to crack down on corruption and initiate dividends. I think you have this a very similar concept in a very different nation in the form of Korea with the corporate value up program, which means get your stock value up. And that's all tied in with the bull case for Japan, which I think still has legs. I think it's generally optimistic on Asian equities as a basket. I think we've got a bull case here that's unfolding. We'll see if the rip-roaring rally here in the last 2 months in China ends up continuing to play out. The thing I'm pessimistic about is U.S. retirements. How much can your home appreciate from time zero onwards? The cohort that has that is in retirement right now experienced, past tense, that home price appreciation. The person purchasing today, what will be the annual appreciation from here, or will you get a sideways chop? Because there's a lot of pink people, I know it. They think, I'm going to live off of whatever equity comes in my home as I move out of the family home and into an apartment in my 60s, plus Social Security, and I'll get by. If you take one of those two legs out, because most people, we've seen the statistics, in their 401k, the typical 401k in this country is like $50,000. Good luck. Have at it.
Yeah.
That's not going to do it. And I'm worried about that. And we, you know, this is not going to come as any big surprise to anyone. We've been talking about it as a society for years. Nobody's ever going to try to rectify Social Security. Neither of the two political parties in the U.S. are ever going to do anything about it. It's a Ponzi. It's well known that it's a Ponzi. And I'm worried about the born too late cohort. And I don't have the foggiest idea how to get out from underneath this thing. And so that's something that really, really is disconcerting to me. And I just don't know. I just think that
it won't be a slow change. It'll be crisis, necessity, change as always, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
It blows up.
But I was always told when I was a young guy, count on Social Security amounting to zero. And of course, I'm literate and I'm a financial geeky guy that reads this stuff. So I've always assumed my Social Security benefit will be zero. Unfortunately, 99 out of 100 people don't give 2 seconds of thought to this concept at all. And I also think that people love to extrapolate out into the future forever. And they're going to find that maybe the house that they bought for $500,000 in 2024 is also $500,000 in 2034. And they weren't banking on it. So I would be very careful.
All right, gentlemen, thank you so much. Rod, it's great to see you again. It's been a while. Jeff, great to see you again. Sam, terrific to meet you. That was a fascinating conversation, guys. Thank you so much. And thank you so much for your value, your incredibly valuable time and your insights.
Thanks, thank you. Pierre.
Our pleasure.
Thanks, Sam. Thanks, Jeff.